This week on the Ocean Cruises podcast, we are speaking with John Kretschmer, delivery skipper, passenger instructor, and author. John is one of the most experienced sailors in the world, clocking close to 400,000 nautical miles sailed in a variety of boats all over the planet. He has spent 42 years in the sailing industry and given over 150 offshore training passages and lectures on passage makings in some of sailing's most prestigious venues. His books include some of the sailing industry's bestsellers and go-to reads for cruisers all over the world. His vessel is a 1987 Kaufman 47 built in Taiwan and is a well-respected, time-proven blue water cruiser and is currently sailing in the Arctic. If you want to follow John's journey around the planet, you can visit his website, johnkretschmersailing.com.
When did you spend time in Malaga then?
Oh boy, I've been sailing to the Med since the mid 80s. With Quetzal, I was actually just working it out not long ago. Probably spent the better part of 5 or 6 seasons and 4 or 5 years in the Med.
All right.
Staying over after transatlantics. Yeah. So went up into Malaga once and stayed there. Taji and I have driven through there. There's a cool Picasso museum there in Malaga.
Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, that's where he's from, I think.
Yeah, it is where he's from. Yeah, it's he's a strange artist, Picasso. It's like he did some incredible murals. He did a few really good paintings. But a lot of his work, honestly, it's like you just think he was on meth or crack. It's like, what on earth is this? And how is it in a museum? Some of it, but he was a very good sculptor as well, actually. Some of his sculptures are really good.
Yeah, and I think he made his living painting portraits in the beginning. I mean, he was a very structural artist as well as a madman. Yeah.
Yeah. We've just got a local artist. He's from Malaga, but he's getting quite popular now. He's actually the personal artist for Antonio Banderas.
Wow.
The actor. And he's like good friends of him. They're always together on Instagram and stuff. Yeah. But me and my sailing friend, who's a regatta skipper, who basically taught me how to sail quicker. we've both decided to like jump in and get some artwork commissioned by him. And I think we get it in a couple of weeks. So I'm really looking forward
fantastic.
To that.
Yeah, very cool. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. Nice. Something about art that is, it just is good for the human spirit.
Yeah. I completely agree. Yeah. We're looking forward to getting something that we'll actually enjoy looking at. I'm a bit worried actually, because we sat in this room with him and he was like asking me questions about my life. I'm like, listen about. And then he was like, no, I want to capture your painting and I want to capture your personality in a painting. I was like, oh shit. Like, yeah, it could be. Yeah.
Wait a minute, that's not me.
Although, that's just paint a different type of picture of my personality. That would be better for me. But no, it's something that will be hanging in the boat that we get next. So,
you guys have a Moody? Is that what I read?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, Moody, a 34-foot Moody. Yeah. It's incredible. I mean, I imagine you've sailed a bunch.
Two Moodys across the Atlantic back in the late 80s, actually, straight from the factory.
Wow. Yeah. So, okay. Marine Projects, the factory
Marine
was
Projects,
called.
Exactly.
Yeah, yeah.
They used to laminate hulls for everybody back in that time.
That's true.
Yeah. So.
Yeah, they were really leading it back in the day. And they, I think they then ended up going into like a joint venture with Princess, you know, the motorboats.
Oh, did they? Okay. Is that where they went to? Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that it's a German company now. It's owned by Hans or Hanse, however you want to pronounce
it. Okay. Interesting. Yeah.
Yeah.
Great consolidation for sure.
Yeah, they're amazing boats. They're so strong. I mean, I've had that. Well, I've only sailed it in the Mediterranean because we basically got it just a coastal cruise and get my wife a bit of experience on the water. And it can handle anything. Like it really can.
Boats for sure. I can picture that. What year is yours?
1995.
Yeah, tough boat for sure.
Yeah,
it kind of made a really nice comeback, actually. I mean.
Oh yeah,
They wagged for a while, but there's some cool designs. That retro Moody they have now.
The 41 footer.
Yeah,
that is gorgeous.
A beautiful boat for sure.
It's incredible. Yeah, yeah. Unfortunately, it's like $200,000 more than I want to spend on a boat.
A lot of money.
But
there are great. I've always been partial to UK boats actually because Well, you know, it's windy on that side of the Atlantic, so you have to go a good boat.
Yeah, you need something a little bit heavy. You know, there's not that many now, which is like kind of depressing. I mean, we were really like leading the charge earlier on.
There's rustlers hanging on, but
yeah, that's pretty much it.
That's about it, for serious boats.
Yeah, the good ones have all gone. There is, I think it's a 64-foot Moody, obviously the best one, but that's getting up to like 800 to a million.
Yeah.
And I think they stopped making them in like the mid-2000s. Mm. But yeah, I'd love like a 50-foot Moody, but you know, I don't have $1 million, unfortunately. So just need a friend who's got one, and then I can enjoy one that way. We're getting a Janot. It's a Janot 54DS.
Oh, that's what you are getting.
Yeah, that's what we're going to get probably at the end of the year.
Wow, congrats. That's really exciting.
Yes, good, good boat. Cool boat. Yeah, we've really studied them a lot because we're going to live on it full time, and we're going to do charters on it. But like all inclusive charters, and you know, we feed people and we give them like some training on how to sail and passage plan and all that type of stuff. But yeah, it was a pretty difficult search because trying to find a boat that is safe, sturdy, strong, but also is like quite livable as well, like a lot of space for guests and you know, multiple families and stuff. It's difficult.
Great time to be looking at boats because the market is so hot. And so
it's crazy.
It's crazy. Yeah. You know, Genoza, my mom sailed her old Genoa, Gin Fizz, around the world in the 80s.
Oh, wow.
And I sailed that boat across the Atlantic twice, I think. They're good old. That's a great boat. No, I'm really good friends with Paul Fenn, who is the president of Genoa America for a long time.
Oh, right.
Yeah.
Okay.
It's cool. Yeah.
You sailed one in Italy with Adam, I think. Was that a Genoa?
That was a Beneteau.
Oh, that was a Beneteau. Yeah. Right. Okay.
It was an Oceanus 485 or something like that, I think.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. But we chartered Genoas all over. Certainly, I used to, in fact, talking about the Med, when Kitsall was living or wintering over in the Med, I would often charter a Genoa 53 from Sunsail and in Tortola. And then we'd actually do a pretty interesting trip. We'd sail directly from Tortola to Grenada, which is 400 tough nonstop miles kind of punching across the Caribbean.
Yeah.
Stay in the Grenadines for 3 or 4 days and then sail straight back. I bet we did that with the 53 maybe 5 or 6 times. And the boat always did interesting. Well. Yeah.
Well, the 53 is the lighter, less blue waterish version of the 54DS, but still a really good boat.
Yeah, and 54 will be a good boat for you guys for sure. Where are you going to base out of?
Well, what we plan on doing is circumnavigating. We want to try and get it done in about 15 years. Like, we want to take our time.
That sounds great.
Might turn into 30. Who knows? But we're going to start in the Med anyway. Like, we're based in Spain. We're going to keep property in Spain anyway to rent out. And
so you guys are able to navigate the Schengen shuffle after Brexit and all of that now?
Luckily, just about. Yeah. So we relocated to Spain like just after the Brexit vote, but about a year before Brexit actually happened.
Right.
And very lucky on the timing there, because I lived in the Middle East for like 10 years and the concept of Brexit wasn't really factored into moving back to Europe. It's just like, as it happened, I was like, well, it's a good thing we're in Europe now. so much in the air about that still.
Oh, yeah. Well, it's such a program for non-EU sailors. You're 90 days in and then you have to be 90 days out. The boat can live for a while in the Schengen zone, but you have to get out if you don't have some kind of visa arrangement.
It must be one of the last things on politicians' minds, you know, like I'm sure they just see us as like sea gypsies or something like that.
What they don't see is that we spend a fortune wherever we go.
In marinas and chandleries and stuff.
We're not big priority, especially at the moment in Europe. Crazy.
Yeah, if England had a, if the UK had a prime minister that was a sailor, I think like the whole Brexit negotiation would have been really different.
You know, they used to. They have had.
Oh yeah.
In the past, what was his name? Heath.
Edward. Oh, Heath. Yeah, back in the 1930s, was it something like that?
I think even more, maybe the 60s or 70s. He was quite a big time.
Oh,
sailor.
Okay.
Yeah, and he would never have let that nonsense happen.
I look into that. I didn't know we had any prime ministers that sailed. Edward Heath, was it?
Was it Edward Heath? Maybe, yeah.
I'm not 100%. I'm okay with politics, the last 10 years. And I know my Winston Churchill, but other than that, much interest. British politicians are relatively boring compared to American politicians.
Was much of a sailor.
No, I doubt he was. He sent ships all over the place, but yeah, he wasn't sailing them. So I think we're going to potter around the Med for like 5 years. Want to do a couple of years between Greece and Turkey, year Italy, France, year Balearics, and then probably like head out over to the Caribbean
and spend
a bit of time. Nice. Yeah, a bit of time in the Caribbean. But we're mostly looking forward to getting across the Pacific.
Yeah.
That's the most exciting part.
That's the cool plan. You're a young guy to be pulling that together. That's awesome.
Yes. Quite a lot of the hard work.
That's always what it takes.
Yeah, it is. It's just one of those things, I think. But when we actually reach it, if anyone's like, "Oh, how did you do it?" I'll be like, "It was horrible getting here, but now it's nice. Now it's okay." Yeah, our journey. So, what are your plans then for like this year going forward? Have you got like all your cruising lined up and your courses, everything?
You know, we are so planned. Sometimes it's crazy because of what we do with these training passages. I mean, we have it's a pretty amazing business, Andy. We, literally we are super fortunate. We post the trips that we're going to run and we sell them out essentially instantly. And so, but by doing that, we're kind of roped into a schedule. So, but in a way, it's probably one of the reasons why we've logged so many miles. We never have an excuse for not going. We have to go. But so Taji and I are in Paris right now. We have a little apartment here that we've rented that serves as our home base since all our kids are out on their own. And it just seems more reasonable to be here than the States right now. And so then we're going to fly to St. Martin tomorrow. And the first leg of our big one, as I'm calling it, which wasn't a very inventive name, but we're going to sail from St. Martin to Bermuda, catch our breath, Bermuda to Nova Scotia. Nova Scotia with friends and longtime crew members, we're just going to make our way up to St. John's, Newfoundland. Then we have a big sail from there up the Lab Coast, over to Greenland, around through the Prince Christian Sound, hopefully, if the sea ice lets us through there. And then Iceland, Faroe, Shetlands, Norway. That's the summer plan.
Wow. Okay. Yeah. All right. Fair amount of passage planning going into that then.
Oh, there has been a lot of scheming and planning. And it's been great because it's not been great, but over the last couple of years, really have had so many obstacles to overcome with COVID. And Taji is just on top of every single regulation, logistical requirement. Mm-hmm. And now even with COVID diminishing, she's on top of it for every country we go to. So yeah, she is definitely the project planner.
You know, that must be such a difficult, I mean, it's difficult anyway, like traveling around and going in between countries and especially like your business, because you have different nationalities on board.
Yeah.
So there's that, which is hard anyway, but then during COVID, it just puts it on steroids. Yeah.
And then, just the entire vaccination issue among some people. So we were constantly juggling things, but we were able to keep moving pretty well, which was kind of a testament to Taji figuring out where we could go. And also we came up with a beautiful invention. We created the Passage to Nowhere. The U.S. Virgin Islands stayed open through most of the pandemic or all the pandemic.
Okay.
And they had a really good regime for testing and people would come and we knew we were all healthy. And then we would just sail into the heart of the Caribbean. We'd make seafall instead of landfall, go for a swim, even if it was windy, get back aboard, and then sail back to the Virgin Islands. You know, 3 or 4 days of reaching and 3 or 4 days of reaching back. It was perfect. Actually, people loved it, and it was cool.
Yeah, it's pure sailing. Yeah, it would be. I mean, if you're picking up the trades as well, you're just on a beam reach all the way down and up. Then,
exactly.
Yeah, it would actually be really nice.
It was. Yeah. It was nice not having a destination.
Yeah.
It was all about sailing. And you sort of, sometimes I think the notion of going somewhere spoils what was the charm of how all of us learned to fall in love with sailing, which was just to sail.
And I think so.
Freed up of that, you know, that waypoint and not being a slave to a little X on the chart was really cool, for sure.
Yeah, definitely. And you know, like when you're doing a passage that, you know, anything above a few days, really, it's like you're always fixed on the end. You're always waiting for the end, and you're thinking about the end. We're going to get there in this many hours. We've got this many miles left, and it's like, yeah, to erase that, you just immerse yourself in the sea.
I've been trying really hard to sail that way, even when we are going somewhere, to default for good sailing, default for nice motion on the boat, default for, you know, just a better point of wind. And it's crazy, you know, you get there about the same time anyway, and you just change the equation of it all being defined by the landfall.
Yeah.
And you know, I've sort of been making a case that sailing shouldn't be defined only by miles sailed or passages made, because it is the in-between that is the cool part of it. And yet when we describe them, oh yeah, it was a passage from here to there. And that's how it's defined, when in fact it was the beautiful time was in there. And those just happen to be the beginning and ending points.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it's the days in the middle where you're not thinking about anything and you're just looking around or looking at the stars or smelling the water. Nice. Like,
we've actually gone so far as recently to turn the GPS off and just use celestial navigation, which is a really fundamentally different way of thinking about the world, because you never really know where you are, but you kind of always know where you're going. And so it's crazy liberating not watching the digits just, you know, decrease 10th of a mile by 10th of a mile. It's nice to just get that out of your life for a while.
Yeah, that would be so good. Let's just talk about your business for a bit, because I mean, it's one of a kind, and it's amazing what you've been able to set up.
Yeah, it's been a,
like, when did you think about this? Because you were doing deliveries, you were a skipper. When did you think about setting up a business where, like, you're passing on your knowledge to people from all over the world?
Yeah, no, it is for sure. There are people, I've had people from all over the world join me, and it's actually a pretty practical reason why I started the business. Is when I had kids, I had to have a more predictable schedule than being a delivery skipper. I love delivering sailboats. It was really the dream job for me, because, you know, you'd get a call, you'd agree to a trip, you'd hop on a plane to England or wherever you were going, and you'd be gone for months at a time. And it was, and when you were done, you gave the keys back to the owner and you went on your way.
The problem is no maintenance. Yeah.
Exactly. With a list of what you should fix.
But it perfect, was, actually.
Yeah. It was a really wonderful life, but it was a hard life to plan around children. So when the kids came, I was delivering. At that point, I kind of evolved into a really good gig. I had some serious clients as their delivery skipper who would say, look, I want my boat in the Caribbean sometime now. And they would work around my schedule. And one of those clients of mine had a Hilux 49, and he only wanted the boat in the Caribbean in the winter and Chesapeake in the summer. And he said, you know, boat's yours to use any way you want. Why don't you take paying passengers on these deliveries? And I went like, wow, that's a cool idea. And then that's how the business got started. And then he had to sell the boat a few years later. So I bought Kitsall very much with the plan to do a training passage business.
Nice.
And it works good for me, Andy, because I'm, you know, a lot of sailors are loners maybe, or introverts naturally. I am not. I'm an extrovert, and I like people, and I love the little community that unfolds on every one of our passages.
Yep.
I dig it, and we get to know each other. We become really great friends. I mean, it sounds corny as hell, but the coolest thing about my business is my best friends today, without doubt, I all met them as customers in my business. Nice. And I've had people sail with me 10 times, 11. I mean, I must be a horrible teacher because they keep coming back.
Or a nice guy, one of the two.
Something like that. But yeah, no. So it's really been a really cool business where a lot of the people signed on for this leg's big, you know, hard trips are all former crew members. In fact, virtually all of them are. So, yeah.
Is it the type of people that that come on these trips with you? Are they usually experienced, like coastal cruisers, perhaps, and they want to do a bit of offshore? Or do you get people who've never sailed before and they're just like, if we're going to go sailing somewhere, we may as well do it with you?
More of the former than the latter. Most people have sailed to some degree. A lot of them are wondering if offshore sailing and, you know, serious cruising, deep ocean sailing is what is for them or not. And they kind of want to give it a test run. Some of them know that they're not going to buy their own boat and they're hungry for adventure and they're willing, you know, they'll do two or three trips with me a year as sort of solves that problem for them. And yeah. But for the most part, they are moderately experienced and in some cases, really great sailors. I've had a lot of, you know, Great Lakes racing sailors. I've had guys who've done that. There's a big race in the Midwest in the U.S. called the Chicago Mack Race. I've had guys who've done that 20 times. And I've had, you know, several people have done the Fastnet Race, but they've never really made long passages. Mm-hmm. And then I have a mix of people who are just, they want to go cruising and they look at this as like a step they have to take before they make the big plunge.
Yeah.
It's interesting because, you know, it's sometimes a little different than you think. It's changed to where now it's maybe 70% male. And a lot of times, you know, couples don't both want to go sailing. And sometimes I have ladies whose husbands don't want to go sailing. And it's just, if you can't make it work as a couple, this is kind of an outlet for you as a single person too. And yeah, it's really interesting the people who turn up to a person though, they just kind of get it. Because one of the things people often ask me is like, oh, you must have some people who come aboard that you can't stand there. And it's almost never the case. I mean,
yeah,
literally almost never. Everybody who gets there wants to be there. In fact, they're grumpy if the trip doesn't have some disaster or some heavy weather, you know, if it all goes smoothly, it's like, wait a minute, you know?
Yeah.
So, yeah, no, it's the people that find their way into my floating world are pretty amazing.
I think, you know, it's like you get so many different types of sailors. You know, you get some who are incredibly liberal, some are incredibly conservative from different backgrounds, different ideas, all sorts. But I've found that they're generally pretty moderate overall, and they are most often kind. It's really weird that I'd say cruisers. Yeah. But it's very rare that you meet a cruiser that is quite selfish and negative, I'd say.
I completely agree with you. And in fact, they tend to be the types of people who will go out of their way to help others. The cruising community is remarkable. If somebody's in trouble, a call goes out and everybody lends a hand. And there's something really cool about it. You can be in an anchorage and there's a Contessa 26 and a beautiful Oyster 65. And yet Captain's Hour might have everybody aboard. It isn't
nice.
Some of the barriers that seem really intense when people are buying boats or in their life acquiring money or not, they kind of go away sailing. There's a certain sense of the fact we all kind of meet each other and we're all having this, you know, we have the same goals and dreams. And the cruising community is fantastic. And I know that a lot of people that come sailing with me know that or sense that or have heard that and want to become part of that too. It's very, very cool. And you know, you talk about differences in politics or religion. I mean, some people say those are taboo subjects, right? You know, they're not, because if you're going to limit conversation, then you're going to have a weird situation. And we have people from every, political spectrum, and God knows the world's divided today. But it's encouraging when you see five or six people figure out a consensus, figure out a way to all get along, figure out a way to become great friends, even if they have really different views. And I think that's one of the maybe problems with today's world is that we don't cross-pollinate enough with people who we disagree with or whatever. And when you're standing watch with someone, you figure out a way to communicate it. And people really, I love to watch it unfold because I realize that much of the things that divide us are artificial. And in the wilderness, that's the ocean, all the things that really matter, matter. And all that other crap goes away.
Yeah. You know, it's like everybody wants the same thing at the end of the day. It's like, you know, if you speak to somebody who's got an idea about, I don't know, immigration, perhaps something like that, their reasoning behind it most often, I mean, you've always got idiots, but, you know, the reasoning behind it is generally they just want safety for their kids. They want a good school, a nice hospital, whatever. And somebody who wants that same end goal will have a completely different path, idea, or route to get there. You can talk about that type of stuff and you can start to understand how other people work, and it helps.
Yeah, that's really well put. It's exactly right. We all want the same thing. All those of us that are reasonable, especially those of us that want to find our way in small boats out in the ocean, we're thoughtful people and we do have different views on how to achieve those things. And then I love the way you put that, because that's what happens in the cockpit. It just gets discussed and you go, yeah, right. Okay. And you learn something. And, you know, that's been another big takeaway for me. And it's nice to get old in this business because you don't feel like I don't feel like I have to prove myself every passage and provide every answer. And one of the things I learned is that the folks that come sailing with me, they sort of shake the world when they're ashore. And even if they're not experienced sailors, they always have something to contribute to the passage. And my job as a skipper is to figure that out more than it is to tell everyone how to do everything and to really get everybody tuning along and participating in the voyage. And that's really cool to do. And I love doing that. And it's made my job better and easier. Realizing that someone who may not be a great sailor turns out to be an engineer who can fix anything. And just, there's always ways to contribute. And that's part of this community that forms. And it's nice to see.
It's just about being a good team leader, just to figure out what everyone's good at and, make them shine. If they've got a talent, push them to do it.
That's what a skipper is. And when you're a young person, you want to show that you're the man, that, you can do everything. But as you get older and you realize what the way you share is by sharing. What I've learned from the people on my trips, Taji will roll her eyes because I'll say, George said this, and he's a nuclear physicist. But there's just a lot of information that we all share and we all learn a lot. So,
It's interesting what you said about, the idea or the concept of wealth or heritage or whatever just goes out the window when it comes to like cruising. It's because like the most disgusting things about living on a boat, even the richest of people do, unless they're paying somebody to sail them around. When we were cruising around in the summer, there was a ginormous catamaran. I can't remember what it was. So I'm not really a catamaran person. It must have been a 60-foot catamaran. And it was just a guy with his family. It was his boat.
Yeah.
Super, super friendly. And my wife was like, yeah, they're really nice and they're really rich. I was like, well, yeah, he still has to get his hands covered in shit if his toilet breaks. Same as you.
And his generator doesn't start and they can't do. Yeah. I mean, we're all in the same soup for sure.
When did you start doing like all the so you do like a lot of web seminars, you do a lot of online training. When did you decide to add that onto the passage making part of the business?
I have to give Taji full credit for that.
You can, that's all right.
she is the she sort of dragged me screaming into that business.
Right.
It was partially the pandemic like it was for everybody else. And it was also the fact that, you know, I've been lucky. My books have been, have sold well. And I get a lot of emails and, questions from people. And I'm not famous about timely responses. And her idea was, why don't we just put some information out there that instead of you trying to answer everybody's email, we can create, you know, basically meetings where people can join and we can share what we know. So it was a little bit about me being really bad responding to information, emails.
Okay.
And then also it's been a good, you know, good business as well. People have really turned up in bigger numbers than we ever dreamed. It's been a sweet little
business. Yeah, really popular.
Yeah. But we dig it. It's fun. And it keeps the community alive. Our Captain's Hour Zoom call, which is once a month. You know, I was skeptical that people would want to do that. Taji was sure it would work. And it's really become pretty amazing. We have a lot of people who come, they brave whatever time zone they're in to join us. And it's 2 or 3 or sometimes 4 hours of just discussing everything about sailing, from really esoteric details on bearings on steering systems to philosophy of why you should quit your job and go sailing. And
yeah,
it's really, it's cool. And it's, I like the ability to connect with people all more, you know, easily. Although I do confess the idea of giving a talk to 500 people in a live audience is far more entertaining and interesting to me than these virtual meetings.
Yeah.
But in the world we live in today, they've been great. It's been fun for sure.
You know, it's funny that I was having a conversation with Adam just before we got on the podcast. I think you said you're going to try and meet up because he's still in St. Martin. He's
going to meet him boat. In just a couple. I mean, we'll meet him tomorrow or the next day. Yeah.
And we were talking about like the future of sailing, and I wouldn't say skeptical, but I was like, I just hope a lot of this COVID stuff doesn't end up rolling over and becoming normal place, like countries issuing fines on people, just making it much more difficult to actually get about and, you know, live on a boat in general.
You know, I don't know. So the Caribbean's been an interesting laboratory to look at that because they really shut down tight.
Yeah.
And they had to in a way because they had no facilities for dealing with a big outbreak. Islands like Dominica and things, they had literally no emergency room facilities or very limited. So you can understand, and they've been slow to reopen, but now they have reopened and you're just kind of watching the protocols quiet down or even just fall apart altogether. People are going to all the islands. I have a suspicion that the world is going to open up again. You know, I think that like a lot of, Chinese people from 20 years ago when they had various pandemics that broke out that didn't really affect a lot of the world. You know, you'd go to the airport in Hong Kong and people would be wearing masks. You'd be like, what's going on here? I think there'll still be a sensibility of some to be really cautious, but I think in general, the basic humanity of the world needs to kind of reconnect. You need to shake hands and give hugs. And at least that's what I think. I see it happening. And I have a feeling that horrible things like what's happening in the Ukraine will actually serve to reinforce the fact that we need each other more. We need a shared humanity and more human love more than we need so much animosity.
But yeah, I'm for sure.
Crazy optimist.
Yeah, I mean, it's like the world was kind of put on hold. I think everybody's kind of on board now. It's not like in, over the last couple of years, you've had like a lot of groups and collectives who have very much been against people meeting up and going to airports and that type of stuff. What's gone on in Ukraine is like really terrible. And in Russia as well, like there's people in Russia who are getting affected. They've got family in Ukraine. You know,
lots of Russian clients over the years, lots of them. I mean, it's just crazy, the situation.
But I think it's like woke a lot of people up as well. It's like, okay, you know, the COVID has been quite bad. Masks might be inconvenient, but at the end of the day, you're not getting your neighborhood shelled. So let's live. Do you know what I mean?
It's true. Yeah, for sure. I think the world just really, really struggled on how to deal with it because it hit us at a time when there's a lot of division in general. And instead of pulling the world together, like you thought, you know, it might have actually had the opportunity in a weird way of really
it's a shame that it didn't.
Together. Yeah, but it didn't. But now something as horrible as the war in Ukraine, I think, is having that effect where you realize, wow, things, you know, I mean, where I'm sitting right now, I was looking on my iPad the other day, the border to the Ukraine is 600 miles from Eastern France. I mean,
yeah,
it's right there. And so, yeah, this is anyway.
I think another thing that's like kind of like positive, I don't want to say like there's anything really positive, but like a change that's really been noticed is like, you know, you go back to like the Gulf War, you go back to the invasion of Iraq, those types of things. There was still, or maybe politicians were able to convince a lot of members of the public that this was the right thing to do. That's just not happening at all now. Like everybody is very much like, forget about this. Don't send our guys over there. Don't get involved. Don't escalate. And I think the general public is like really moving to the point where, you know, like the 1960s hippies where it's like war is bad. I think everyone's getting back there, which is pretty good.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, it's definitely forced everybody's eyes wide open again.
Yeah. I don't know how we got onto that, but everything can get onto COVID. Do you know what I mean? It's like COVID, Ukraine. Yeah. These are like sort of talking points for everything. Yeah. With regards to like the web training that you do, is that specifically for like passage planning, or is it for, you know, getting your life on a boat? Is the particular things that you discuss?
Yeah, for me, Andy, my shtick really is passage planning and offshore sailing, really. You know, that's kind of the thing that I know best. And I mean, there are people who are much smarter than me and more experienced about living aboard and all the logistics of that. But when it comes to sailing across the Atlantic, I mean, we're doing a two-part webinar next week about how to sail across the Atlantic. And I've been putting it all together the last few days, and I find myself just, you know, just digging it so much because it's information that I know so well about when to sail where and how to interpret the weather conditions and how to handle your boat. And so, yeah, my thing is blue water, passage making, how to sail across an ocean is kind of my shtick more than it is just getting on the boat and living aboard. Yeah. So, yeah. Well, Taji's saying, yeah, we also do a lot of one of our most popular webinars is how to buy boats for blue water cruising. We really have, you know, over the years, I've written hundreds of sailboat reviews, mostly for Sailing Magazine and some for Cruising World. And so, yeah, I have a lot of knowledge about what are good blue water boats. I figured it out, I don't know, maybe 10 years ago that I'd sailed more than 50 different kinds of boats, at least 1,000 miles nonstop at one point. So it brings a lot of perspective to that. Yeah. So.
Yeah. That's, I mean, that could be a 10-hour podcast in itself. That.
That's what I think. Yeah. It's really interesting. That generates strong opinions. There's so many, the sailboat design world is so vibrant right now with catamarans for sure. And, you know, completely different hull shapes on many mono hulls and the argument against longer keels, deeper keels, skegs, fins, or spade rudders. You know, it's really an interesting time to talk boats for sure.
Yeah. You know, like one thought that I had is, you know, it seems like in the 70s, 80s, and probably early 90s, you could buy a boat off the shelf that was pretty ocean worthy in like the 30 foot range, like 30 to 40 foot. That same, you know, if you were to spend the same money, you know, taking inflation into account, for example, now on a boat of that similar size, there isn't that many available. I mean, you've got like your Beneteaus, your Genoes that are like, you know, in the 30, 40 footers. That seems to be like where most people go if they want a newer boat. And they're good for, I think they're a lot better for coastal cruising than the older boats probably were, because they've got more space downstairs. You can put more equipment in them. But it doesn't seem like anyone's really making 40-foot boats specifically for crossing oceans anymore.
Not very many. And those that are, they're really expensive.
Super expensive.
I think it's a logical extension for the sailing business, because the sailing industry, if you follow sort of the arc of fiberglass boats, they evolved from wooden boats. And wooden boats were just by their nature easier to build and longer keel, lower freeboard. They were ocean going boats in general. The early fiberglass boats followed that form, and they didn't really take all the advantages of fiberglass into effect, where you don't need as much structure here or there. You can have a lot more space below. And I think, you know, if you really analyze how many sailors make ocean passages, it's not very many.
No, it's not at all.
So to build your boats for that market, I think, wasn't very smart for them. So they realized exactly right. The vast majority of people coastal cruise, and they use their boats for, you know, condominiums, weekend away from home, all sorts of stuff, and they could build them differently. That design change doesn't speak to me very much, because I love boats for blue water. But I totally understand the direction of sailboat design. Mm. And that's where this discussion is so interesting today, because you're completely right. There are not many off-the-shelf 40-foot boats today that are designed for you to just cross an ocean, whereas in 1986, virtually every one of them was.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah, it's a cool observation for sure.
I think there's going to be like a – probably not now, because so boats that were built in like I'd say the 80s onwards, because like the fiberglass molding started to get a lot better like mid 80s onwards, up to like early 2000s when they started making lighter fiberglass boats. When those boats are no longer able to be in service anymore, like let's say in 20 years when a boat from the 80s has really just had its day, people that want to get a 30, 40 foot boat and blue water cruise, they're really going to struggle. Unless they have a lot of cash, because they're going to be looking for a used boat that may be in the 30, 40 foot range. There's still a couple of $100,000.
Yeah. No, and there's going to be less and less of them available.
Yep.
Because from the heyday of boat production in the late 70s until the recession of the early 80s, basically from the oil embargo of the early 70s to the recession of the early 80s, was the boom time in fiberglass boats. Companies like Beneteau and Genoa had not even really found their stride yet, but were still building a lot of boats. But all over the UK, Moody, and in the US, you know, many production builders, Catalina, Morgan, Hunter, they were building 3,000 and 4,000 boats a year each. Wow. And now if a company builds 100 boats a year, it's pretty remarkable. So the actual gene pool of boats is decreasing. They're more expensive. And you're right. When we're suddenly going to be looking for a 34-foot boat to go cruising in 10 years from now, it's going to be really hard to find something that isn't ancient and that is even close to being affordable.
Yeah.
That's one of the reasons why old dogs, you know, 1980-foot, serious heavy duty Taiwan cruising boats are still commanding money, because the alternative is a new Kraken or new Halberg Rossi or new something that's a lot of money. And there's people that know that. There's an interesting website called Attainable Adventure Cruising. I don't know if you've ever seen it. It's run by this guy, John Harries, and it's for real serious blue water sailing and kind of high latitude sailing. And they've been trying to launch this project about building an affordable 40-foot world cruiser. It's kind of crowdsourced from a lot of really knowledgeable people who tune into the website. It's called the Adventure 40. And I think they're close to where they're actually getting it ready to roll. It's going to be
fiberglass.
Yeah, check it out. It's an interesting project. And they've really, really been, he's tried really hard to come up with a solution to that problem.
Yeah. I'll check that out, actually. That sounds really interesting because that's a dilemma, you know, something that I've thought about. Or like,
exactly.
It's true, though. I mean, if you're looking for a boat like under, you know, 50, 60 grand to go cruising across oceans on, which you can get now, no problem. I think in 20 years, that's going to be real difficult.
Exactly right, for sure.
Yeah. So with regards to like your passage planning, technology has evolved like pretty rapidly over the last 10 years, mostly because of satellites. Yeah. But, you know, crossing oceans now, if you're able to put money into an AIS, a radar, weather routing, you know, an SMS service, it's pretty safe. I mean, you have to be
safer. You know, it's funny. I was thinking while I was actually puttering around this morning about our conversation. So we had Captain's Hour just a couple nights ago. Okay. And I had one couple chime in. They were out in the Tuamotus, and they are sailing a Beneteau Oceanus 50 basically around the world. They're doing great.
Nice.
And they had just sailed from Costa Rica to the Marquesas. And their question that they put in was, you know, we've spent all this time listening to your stuff, preparing for heavy weather, when in fact we just had a 30 days where we never had more than 10 knots of wind. You know, we were totally unprepared for light air. And I said, you know, it's a really interesting question, because the last few crossings I've done have been more light air oriented than heavy. Hmm. And then the next fellow who chimed in was sailing from, I don't know if you know your geography over on the Bahamas side of things, but from the Turks and Caicos, which is like the far eastern end of the Bahamas, up to Maryland.
Okay.
And they ran into 4 days of 30 to 35 knots from the northeast that was essentially forecast to be 10 to 15. They just kind of ran into a ridge where two pressure systems stalled.
Yeah.
And they really got walloped. And it was interesting because for the most part, you're completely right. The weather forecasting through grid models is so reliable today and so easy to obtain that weather information has never been better. And looking 3 or 4 days out in your life is really realistic, and even 5 and 6 sometimes. So you can make super smart decisions. From that standpoint, the weather information has changed the game significantly, but there's still enough uncertainty. I mean, we were really yucking it up with Joe, the fellow who ran in all this heavy weather, saying, you know, I was assuring the crew that we would have this window on the world with weather.
Guaranteed them the perfect journey.
Exactly. Smacked. So, yeah, you know, and there's a weird perverse side of me that still likes that uncertainty.
Yeah.
Because, you know, one of the real reasons we do this is because there's a certain element of risk to it that heightens the reward. And we're all trying to minimize that and make voyaging as safe as we can. But at the same time, knowing that every time you set off on a passage, you've got to be prepared for the possibility of severe weather, of breakdowns, of, you know, of collisions, whatever it is. I mean, that risk element is kind of what brings your senses alive and makes it also worth doing. So,
yeah, for sure. Yeah, it's just about being prepared, isn't it? And I suppose that's like the important thing. It's like, you know, if you set off on any passage at the right time of year, you're most likely to have decent weather.
Exactly.
But yeah, if you don't know what to do on that one day where you just get a hell of a squall,
it's a bad premise to think that you're going to always have the data too.
Yeah.
The data, there's just so many points of failure on a boat, and probably over the span of my sailing career, electrical points of failure have been number one. And there's just lots of ways to suddenly not get the data that you were certain you were going to get. And so, yeah, being prepared by, like you say, sailing at the right time of year in the right ocean. You know, my mom sailed around the world in the 80s, and they basically never ran into a storm. But what they did do was sail at the prime right time in the right ocean. And just by doing that, you mitigate your chances of bad stuff happening dramatically. Yeah.
Well, I just crossed the Atlantic in January. Then we landed in, where did we land? Somewhere in the Caribbean. I can't remember the island. Martinique.
That's a good place. A good food when you land.
It's really nice. I just spent a couple of days in the anchorage when I got there, and then I just potted around the island for the rest of the time. It's really beautiful. The people are like really, really nice as well. When I'm having conversations with people who don't sail or they don't spend any time on the ocean about it, they were like, "That's stupid. Why are you doing that?" And I was like, "Well, if you do it in December or January, it's actually very nice." And they were like, "Okay,
time to go."
Yeah, I was like,
the Canaries or from Cape Verde? Or?
Yeah, well, so, this crossing has taken like 3 years because of COVID. It was my friend's boat. I met up with them in Cadiz and we sailed down to the Canaries. And that was literally as COVID was starting or as the lockdowns were starting, not COVID, because COVID carried on for a long time and we didn't really make that many changes. Right. So it was kind of like a year in, I think. Then we had to wait for a year. We were going to head over that year. And a few people who went over in the Ark, once they arrived, they were messaging us and they were like, "Listen, it's actually quite unpleasant." Yeah. So we left it for a year. During that year, my friends ended up having a baby. So we had a 4-month-old baby on board for this crossing. Yeah, he was fine. He had no issues on this crossing. He had no idea. He probably just thought he was on a really nice ride for like a month. Because we had the baby on board, we didn't want to shoot straight over. We wanted to break it up and stop in Cape Verde. Which was a cool experience. It was definitely the wrong thing to do because we had perfect winds on the stern, which would have literally pushed us straight there. And we basically went we didn't go with the weather to get to Cape Verde.
Right.
And then I think the trip from Cape Verde to the Caribbean, we averaged like 4.2 knots or something miserable. It took way too long.
A little further south, you should be even in better trade winds. But the last time we did that, exactly the same thing happened. We had wind the first day out of Cape Verde and then nothing basically all the way to Martinique. We had just... What kind of boat were you in?
Oh, it was a Beneteau Clipper 361. It wasn't suitable for the journey at all.
But that's the point right there, though. But you did just fine, apparently. Yeah.
Oh, you can do it. I mean, we only passed one of the vessel going from Cape Verde to the Caribbean, and it was a canoe with two people. So, like, when people say, oh, you need a boat like this, you need a boat like this, I'm like, you really just need something that floats, and that's it. Like, you can do it. It was these, it was three guys in a canoe. It was three ex-Navy SEALs, I think.
Right.
They were, like, raising awareness for wounded veterans, that type of stuff. Okay. So we got onto the radio with them, and, it was, like, a really interesting journey that happened.
Put everything in perspective, huh?
Yeah, but so we were, obviously like 1,000 miles in the middle of nowhere, and we thought, we'll turn the AIS off because it's not really doing much for us. If there's a ship, we'll see it. And it was literally by luck that we just didn't run them over. One of the other crew members was like, "What's that floating in it?" And I was like, "I hope it's not a container." I was like, "It's people."
That's great.
You can get over in anything.
For sure. That's crossing and. You know, they used to call that the ladies' trade winds because they're just kind of gentle and it's a great trip. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, I think if you want to break into like longer passages, going from Europe to the Caribbean, it's definitely the easiest and the best way to start because it's so simple.
It's downhill. It's downhill the entire way. Yeah, for sure. It's harder to get back. It's a little more challenging. Yeah.
Definitely. So, I mean, with your business then, the majority of your sailing, I take it would just be doing Atlantic circuits, really, because that's mostly what you do.
We've done, a crazy amount of sailing, lots of Atlantic circuits. And then lots of times we've just done the circuits where whether we've been in Europe or on this side of the world, or on this side, I'm in Paris right now, that side of the world. But where we've made fall passages from like the Canadian Maritimes from Nova Scotia down to Bermuda and down to the Caribbean, or coming from Ireland, cross Biscay to Portugal, and then down to the Canaries that way. We made a lot of those north to south trips and stayed on that side of the Atlantic for a few years without just making crossings. But we've done a lot of Atlantic crossings too. I've done 27 of them.
Wow.
And yeah, so, but the Atlantic's basically been my office with this business. I mean, it's kind of where I go to work every day. And yeah, it's interesting because we have logged on our good old boat somewhere north of 150,000 miles. We've never sailed less than 8,000 miles in a year.
Nice.
And I've had it for 20 years. So yeah, we've had some years where we sailed a lot more, but I'm just kind of holding the line right there.
What's the circumference of planet Earth?
So a typical trade wind circumnavigation, if you kind of mosey around, is about 25,000 miles.
Right. So if you were to just draw a line around the equator, you have lapped the planet many times in that boat. Yeah,
many times. That's just in this boat. Altogether, I've sailed about 400,000 miles. Okay. I know, I look a lot smarter than that, right?
Well, man, you know, sailors who've been on the water for so long usually look like shit, and you're actually quite young. I mean, I don't know how old you are, but you don't look old enough to have 400,000 miles under your belt. Sure.
I've been at it a long time. I've been doing this essentially for 42 years.
Yeah. So how did your life sailing actually start? I mean, you just mentioned your parents, they circumnavigated.
Did you do that as well with them? Sail. My father had passed away. Oh. I was a floundering college student dropping out of college. And, you know, I dropped out and I had a meeting with my mom. And she said to me, you know, I know you're not as stupid as it looks. So
always good to hear from your mom. You look stupid. I hope you're not.
So she said, you know, all you ever do is read those sailing books and sailing magazines. And she made me a deal. If I worked hard for 6 months, whatever I made, she'd match as long as I bought a little boat and took off.
Oh, cool. And,
I was 20 years old and bought a 27-foot Bristol, an old American boat.
Oh, good.
Yeah, took off sailing in that and basically been at it ever since. The big thing for me was back in 1983 and 84, we sailed a Contessa 32. I was 24 from New York to San Francisco around Cape Horn against the wind. And it was an epic voyage that got got some publicity at the time. And I wrote a book about it. And that really got my sailing life off and running. And then I started doing deliveries after that. So, yeah, it was kind of crazy.
Was that something you wanted to do specifically, or could you not get through the Panama Canal or something? Like, it's the long way around, for sure.
No, I was steeped in the history of Cape Horn. I had read all the books. Yeah, it was. We were trying to retrace the route of the clipper ships.
Okay.
Our goal was to do it in an average of their average time was 120 days. And we were trying to equal that. And we didn't, because we had all sorts of obstacles. We were capsized along the way. We calmed in the Pacific for weeks.
You capsized?
Yeah. Yeah. Early on in the trip going south of Bermuda in a tropical storm, it wasn't really a full capsize. It was kind of it was way more than a knockdown. The boat was smashed and the mast went into the water a long way, and I was pitched overboard. And when it righted itself, it was facing 180 degrees the other direction, so it did kind of a crazy pivot underwater, and I was able to get it back aboard. It was a long night for sure, but we pressed on. We actually made landfall, repaired the boat, and carried on. And when we finally got to the Horn, it was pretty cool. We actually rounded the Horn. There was an old saying from the sailing ship era where you sailed from 50 to 50. It meant crossing the 50th parallel, going down around the Horn to the 50th parallel of the Pacific, from the Atlantic to the Pacific. And we managed to do that at that time faster than any yacht had ever done it. in this little tiny contest. I'm sure it's been beaten now, but so yeah, it was a really a voyage with lots of ups and downs, and it taught me a lot about sailing. And
I bet it did. Yeah. But it was funny the way you structured that sentence. It was like we capsized early on and we kept on going. Yeah, yeah.
You know, it's true. There were a lot of opportunities to quit on that. And I didn't. And so,
yeah. I did a podcast with Limpardi, and they did Cape Horn, I think, a few times, two times.
I know all about Larry and I communicated when they were getting ready to do that.
Oh, no way.
Yeah. 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 No, she's amazing. Huh?
Yeah. She sent me some video footage of when they did it in, I think, their second boat, which which is like 27 foot, I think.
Yeah.
Big heavy thing.
Weather
through it.
Well, yeah. Lynn and I have debated that because Taliesin, I think, is 29 and Gigi, our contestant, was 32, but Taliesin weighed twice as much.
Oh, yeah, I bet.
And was longer on the waterline and longer overall, too, with her bowsprit. Mm. So it's,
basically had a diving board on the front of the boat.
Lynn and Larry Pardee were incredible. They inspired an entire generation of cruisers, for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, they inspired me. They for sure. Larry was someone you couldn't help but admire. I mean, to do all that sailing and literally sail, no engine. Completely dramatically different. So many of us say, oh, we sailed across the Atlantic, but we did motor for 4 days or whatever. You know, I mean, they did all that sailing by sailing. And when they did have to get into port, he would scull. He had a long oar that he'd rig up and scull the boat into port. I mean, just amazing.
It's crazy. Yeah. I think I've had about 4 or 5 conversations with her, but we only actually ended up putting one out as a podcast just because we had like some issues of audio and stuff like that.
Yeah.
In one of the chats that I had with her, we were talking about a couple. She said they had issues twice. Like there was two occasions when they were in the boat where the weather was really bad and they couldn't get into port and they just had to, you know, heave to and hang around.
Right.
And it's like some of the conditions that she's talking about, and I'm like, and there was no engine. She was like, no. I was like, well, did that not make you want an engine? She's like, no. And I'm like, what?
I know. I mean, just incredible. And then both of them, boats that they built themselves.
I think that just adds to it. It's like, not only did they sail around the world with no engine, it's like they just made those things with their hands.
Yeah, which, exactly. I mean, it's
so impressive.
Whole story. Yeah, I think that Larry Pardee, you know, Lynn had asked me to do a comment for the film about him, and I was slow to do it. But I think the thing that he was a master of was understanding time, because a lot of people would say, you know, in the prime of their sailing life, they took 7 years out to build a new boat. Mm. But he realized that that time was as valuable as the sailing time. I think he had a really, and Lynn as well, but Larry in particular had a really profound sense of how to spend the time of his life. And I think that's how you live a good life, is understanding that.
Mm.
Yeah.
She's just taken off again.
I know.
Which is like amazing. She's well into her late 70s, I think.
Yeah.
She still loves it. And it's the first time she'd have really sailed a boat that's got an engine.
which is
crazy as well.
I was like eating.
What's it going to be like circumnavigating with an engine? And she just burst out laughing. She was like, oh yeah, that is strange for me.
That's funny.
So when you give these when you go into like the passage planning training with the courses that you run when you're on the boat, do you tend to focus more on like the traditional methods of passage planning, not putting that much weight into like the modern technology?
Not so much. Quetzal is extremely well rigged. We have powerful headstay furling. All the sails are on furlers. We're thinking about sailing. I tend to sail in a way. I guess I should answer this a little more cleanly. But what I do try to emphasize is that good seamanship is what you're trying to achieve. And by that, I teach things that are sometimes not readily apparent and make so much sense when you've logged a lot of miles. If you're gonna reef, you need to set your boat up so that you can reef off the wind. It just isn't practical to think you're going to be in a gale and you're going to come upwind and set everything flogging to shorten up. So there's a lot of sort of hard-won practical experience that I teach. But the overall premise of, I think, my message is that you need to really tune into your boat, listen to your boat. You don't, it isn't a competition per se. In fact, it's as far from a competition as you can make it. That any, you know, crossing an ocean is more of a experience than something you want to just make a notch on a tree. It's a powerful, magical interlude in your life where you're not constricted by all the land things. And so I don't know, I guess I'm being very philosophical about it, but I try to explain or at least share my belief that there are lots of different ways to do it, but that the key is that you don't miss it by worrying about all the details. You get your head out of the screens, you look around, you look out for, and you see a canoe out there with three guys crossing the Atlantic. I mean, you could have bolted right past it on autopilot, head in screen, you know, all just looking at the data. So we're very, I teach kind of a natural way of sailing. I think that a lot of times people, you know, you can cross the Atlantic, sail around the world and never hand steer. And I think you miss something because it's when you're steering your boat is when she talks to you. And
yeah,
so things like that, silly stuff, but very, very honest. And then we're totally tuned into different weather observations. And you know, I'm good at teaching both traditional means and weather observation, as well as we're very, you know, we get grip files every chance we can. And we, you know, we're constantly thinking about how the voyage can play out. But at the same time, we're not just in this dash to get where we're going. We're really trying to emphasize that the time at sea is magical and good sailing is always the right default.
Yeah. You know, it's like the philosophical part of what you're saying, I think is so true. You know, like when you're out there and you just, I mean, you're not alone. You've generally got somebody with you unless you're a solo sailor, which I have huge respect for.
But the
best moments are the ones where you do just realize you're completely alone and you look around and you're like, gosh, it is literally just me and, you know, the Atlantic and that's it. I'm like really envious that you have been able to live the majority of your life just immersed in those moments, like all the time. Very cool.
It's been good for sure. And I think that one of the things, you know, we don't often think of the ocean as a wilderness, but to me, it's really the great wilderness of our planet. It's hard to be alone anywhere on land. There's so much information tracking it all. And you can be tracked at sea too, but you're a long way away from help when you're in the middle of the ocean. It's not like any Coast Guard is going to just launch a plane or a helicopter to rescue you. It really is a wilderness. And all of the beauty of wilderness applies to the sea. You think of so much great nature writing, and it really applies to the ocean too, because that's where the wilderness is today. So you're right. I feel really fortunate to have been out there a lot.
When did you start writing books, or when did you start publishing books? Maybe not.
Yeah, I always wanted to write. That was sort of, you know, back in school when they asked, you know, what do you want to do on career day? I would say I wanted to sail around and write books about it. And, you know, your teachers would go, oh my God, come on.
They can't help you with that one.
But, you know, it's funny. I had one of my old high school English teachers sail with me. He sailed with me twice now. And he told the crew, you know, he said, you know, I was a high school athlete, a college athlete. I was a pole vaulter and I was pretty good at it.
Oh,
and,
nice.
He told the crew, he said, you know, I thought there was a small chance John might make the Olympics as a pole vaulter, but I never dreamed he'd write a book. But okay. No, I wrote it. You know, I did want to write always. And I'm a voracious reader. And I think those two go hand in hand. And I wrote a book about the Cape Horn trip. And it's funny because it didn't do very well. It got some nice reviews, but it didn't sell. But it always stayed in print. And now it's been reprinted. And it's part of a series of Mariner's classics and all this sort of thing. And yeah, it's interesting. If you hang in there long enough, good things happen. But I've been lucky. My books have done very well. They've sold well, and it's allowed me to share my message with a bunch of people, and that's cool for sure. Sailing a Serious Ocean is one of the best-selling sailing books of the last 20 years, one of like the top three or four. And yeah, it's pretty amazing to me because when I put it together, I thought it was a hodgepodge. But yeah.
You know, like me and my wife are planning on sailing around the world and we're really looking forward to it. Being on a boat, being in an anchorage, sailing across an ocean, it's not something that I imagine doing till I die. Okay. Like I have an idea of eventually we'll probably just get a little cruiser and we'll have a house somewhere, whatever. Yeah. You have literally lived on the water the majority of your life. Could you ever see yourself not doing this?
Well, that's a really good question. So yes, I have lived on the water most of my life. I've sailed a lot, but I've also had a land life here. I did have two daughters and Taji has two sons and we merged our families together. So I've had land living for sure. But my job, my love really has always been sailing, and I've never not sailed thousands of miles every year of my life. So for me, it's more that I've made ocean passages all of my life, more than I've just lived aboard nonstop. So yeah, I mean, Taji loves Paris. We have this cool little apartment. So a land base is part of our program as well. Mm-hmm. Can I ever see myself selling Quetzal and not sailing? No.
Yeah.
I mean, honestly, it's probably stupid to say. I just can't imagine ever selling the boat. It's funny though, because I always say that, you know, when the time comes, I'm just going to sail off to Valhalla. And Taji lately has said, no, you're not. I'm going to push you out in the dinghy. I'm keeping the boat.
Right. Okay. Yeah. It's a pretty impressive boat. At what point did you make your mind up that that was the final boat for you?
I don't think when I bought it, I thought it was. And it's, she's just, you know, you just kind of get attached at the hip to the boat you've done all this sailing on. And, you know, there's a philosophical theory called Theseus's ship. Okay. Theseus was the founder of Athens. And his ship was on display kind of in the main plaza there in Athens, and supposedly back in 600 BC. And it rotted, but the town always put new pieces in it. And by the time Aristotle came along, there was basically nothing left of the original Theseus ship, but it was still there because it had been rebuilt. And he said, this isn't really Theseus's ship anymore. It's a new boat. And sometimes I feel that way about Quetzal, because we have done so much to it. We have changed everything and we've rebuilt this and relaminated that. And so she's an old boat, but she has been loved and refit and reworked so many times. And after you do all that to a boat, you get pretty close to it.
Yeah.
And we've done all the work ourselves. I've got an amazing group of friends that just come and help me. I mean, I'm the original Tom Sawyer of sailing, and I have people just turn up and they bring their tools and I supply the stories and the food. And
it's good trade. Good trade. So
I don't know. At this point in the game, it would be hard to think about not sailing her. But yeah, she's almost like a new boat in some ways. New mast, new rigging, new sails, even a relaminated bottom of the hull. We've done all sorts of cool stuff.
Mm.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it would be a one of a kind if it did find its way onto the market. Yeah, it'd definitely be a special one.
Yeah.
Yeah. We've only had the Moody, I think, about 4 years now, because it's the first cruising boat I ever had. I had smaller boats before, but it was just for, you know, going out in the bay and coming back in. And the guy who's actually buying my boat, he contacted me and he was like, oh, can I come and see it? Then as soon as he saw it, he was like, I want to buy it. I hadn't actually thought about selling it until he said, I want to buy it. I was like, well, it kind of works in timeline. So that's, and I'm really busy this year and I've got passages coming up anyway. And, you know, I was just like sat there and looking around. I'm like, I did all the pumps. I did the upholstery. I did all this. And I'm looking and I'm like, and I call my wife and I'm like, I think I'm sad. Yeah. Like, I really don't want to actually do that. But you get attached to them.
You do. And there's that stupid saying, the happiest 2 days of your life when you buy and sell. Mm. It's not, you know, I've had other boats too, and I've never been happy selling them. I mean, you know, it's funny because Ataji hates this story, but she sometimes says, you know, Ataji's a beautiful woman, but she says, you know, when I was rowing away from the boat or motoring off in the dinghy, I look back at it. She says, you never look at me the way you look at that boat.
I bet there's a lot of sailors whose wives would probably say the same thing, to be fair.
But anyway, no, if you don't feel that way about your boat, you should be doing something else, I think.
yeah, true. Well, listen, if anybody wants to book on any of your passages, what's the best way for them to do that?
So the best way for sure is to go to our website. It's easy. It's johnkretschmersailing.com. And Taji's really good on social media. She's got a pretty active John Kretschmer Sailing Instagram and Facebook page. And basically, you know, you go and check things out, and we still kind of communicate entirely by email. Honestly, it's hard to get aboard the passages, but certainly berths open up when people cancel, and there are a lot of opportunities to join us for Captain's Hour. And we've got webinars, new webinars coming all the time. In fact, we have these, how to cross the Atlantic webinars coming up now. And we have lots of, just go to the website. There's all sorts of cool stuff there.
Brilliant. It sounds like the only problem with your business is there's only one of you.
Well, you know, it's funny. You led into a good point there. We do have, we've partnered recently, or we kind of recommend another young couple, Nathan and Vivian, who are great friends of ours. And they have a boat, a Compass 47. And we refer clients to their passages as well. And they've just done a great job. They're in their third year now, and their business is also, their trips are often full, but they have more openings than we do. And we do a lot of passages together. Nice. So, so you'll see them on our website as well. So their company is called Ocean Passages. Fantastic couple. Nathan is a capable sailor, and Vivian is a wonderful chef, a good sailor. And they really, they run very cool trips. So,
nice.
So you'll see there. If you go to the website, their information is there as well.
Yeah, perfect. I'll put all the details in the podcast link. And listen, John, thanks very much for your time. I know you're busy and you're about to shoot off tomorrow, so really appreciate it. And thanks for sharing a bit more about your background and your story. It's been great.
My pleasure, and thanks very much for having me.
Welcome.